Read Japanese Literature. My name is Allison Fincher. Read Japanese Literature is a podcast about Japanese fiction and some of its best works. All the works we discuss are available in translation, so you can read along if you want. You can find out more at readjapaneseliterature.com. First of all, I want to say thank you for your patience. I think RJL may just be a 10-episode-a-year podcast, January to May, August to November, and any extras I can put out are bonuses. But we have a lot of great content to cover in those 10 episodes. In the next few months, I'm hoping to talk about Yukio Mishima and misogyny in Japanese literature. Not that there's not plenty in Anglo-American literature. We're just a podcast about Japanese literature. I hope to talk about Zainichi Korean literature, Japanese dystopias. But today, we're covering the life and work of Kenji Miyazawa, an author of the late Meiji, Taisho, and early Showa eras, who was really nothing like the other authors of his time. He wrote not eye novels, but poetry and children's stories. He wasn't writing for the literati, the bundan, but for the farmers. And he wasn't writing fiction of secularization and individuality, but fiction of faith and community. The episode is going to be a little bit different. We're going to spend today's entire episode on Miyazawa's biography, but on our way, I'm going to weave in three stories that celebrate the projects of Miyazawa's life. We'll talk about Miyazawa's Nichiren Buddhist faith, along with his story, The Bears of Namatoko. We'll look at his desire to fight for the underdog, alongside the tale, Ozbel and the Elephant. And we'll end by talking about his death and legacy, along with the story, Gosh the Cellist. Patreon content will include an extra story, a little bit more about the history of Kenji Miyazawa's times, and other little tidbits. It isn't too late to sign up if those are topics you want to hear more about. Patreon.com/readjapaneseliterature. Kenji Miyazawa was born in 1896, near the end of the Meiji era, and he came of age under the so-called Taisho democracy. That makes him a near contemporary of Ryunosuke Akutagawa, who was born in 1892. 1896 was also the year Ichio Higuchi published the story Takekurabe. We talked about Akutagawa and Higuchi in Season 1 episodes. The story of Kenji Miyazawa's life is closely tied to his home in Iwate Prefecture. When Miyazawa published the only volume of fiction during his lifetime, a collection of children's stories, he set them in a land he called Iatov. And that's a romanization. It's a little bit difficult to guess how he would have wanted the word pronounced in English. But he explained that Iatov was the Iwate Prefecture of Japan as a dreamland that exists in the mind of the author, a kind of idealized vision of his homeland. And he often used Iwate dialect in his stories. Iwate Prefecture is in Tohoku. We talked about Tohoku in depth in our episode about Fukushima fiction, but let's give ourselves a little refresher. Tohoku literally means northeast. It's the northeastern part of the main Japanese island, Honshu. Over the course of many centuries, Tohoku became the breadbasket of Japan, or perhaps the rice basket. Most of the region isn't especially suited for the kind of wet rice agriculture that Japan uses to produce rice. That means Tohoku was also susceptible to famine when the weather ruined crops. Nevertheless, Tohoku provided the wealthier, more prestigious centers of power with the resources needed to thrive, and it became dependent on the income from selling resources to the center of power. Tohoku is kind of a peripheral region that many people have justifiably claimed has been exploited by the centers in Japan, particularly Tokyo. The marginalization of people in Tohoku is important to Miyazawa's life for a couple of reasons. One, it helped to instill a lifelong commitment to marginalized people, especially farmers. and we'll discuss that commitment in the second section of the episode. 2, Miyazawa's ties to a part of Japan so far from Tokyo shaped his life as a writer. His writing is different than what anyone in Tokyo was producing, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode. And the literary establishment, the Bundan, made it difficult for anyone who didn't live in Tokyo to access the publishing world. Keep that in mind when we think about how little of Miyazawa's work was known during his lifetime. And the third reason that the marginalization of people in Tohoku is important to Kenji Miyazawa's life is that it set him up for a lifetime of conflict with his father, Masajiro Miyazawa. Masajiro Miyazawa inherited his retail business from his own father and built that business into a wholesale empire. I've heard Masajiro described as a pawnbroker, which is true, but a dramatic understatement. The family was one of the wealthiest and most powerful in the region. You'll notice that I will never mention a single worry about money in the entire story of Kenji Miyazawa's life. Masajiro's wife Ichi bore their first son on August 27, 1896, Kenji Miyazawa. And as the firstborn, Kenji was expected to inherit his father's business. But Kenji was never a happy successor. As a child, he despised helping out in his father's stores, and he hated his father's bourgeois attitude. The day he entered junior high, he wrote a poem about how embarrassed he was with his father's petty displays of wealth. "Father, father, why, in front of the superintendent, did you wind your large silver watch?" By the way, this poem is one of more than 1,000 he wrote before graduating from high school. Kenji and his siblings also grew up in a religious household. His parents were devout, true, pure land Buddhists. I'm going to talk about 2 Buddhist schools of thought for the next few minutes. It is my intention to give a truthful and respectful overview. Talking about living religious traditions is tricky. Please let me know if I have failed to be truthful or respectful. As always, I'll happily publish corrections. I could tell you a lot more about Pure Land Buddhism. As a matter of fact, we discussed it in season 1 episodes about the tale of the Heike and about medieval Japanese Buddhism. But to very briefly summarize, anyone can call on the name of a certain Buddha, Amida Buddha, when they are dying, and then enter the Pure Land after they die. In case you don't know, Buddha isn't a name, it's a title. It means awakened, and it applies to someone who has discovered the path to nirvana and then teaches others so they, too, can discover the path. Nirvana is release from the cycle of death and rebirth that we sometimes call reincarnation. Beyond these basics, different schools of Buddhism define what makes a Buddha and what his or her or their abilities are differently. So this is the tradition in which Miyazawa was raised, but when he was 18 years old, he was extraordinarily moved by a new Chinese-Japanese edition of the Lotus Sutra. The full Sanskrit title of the Lotus Sutra is the Sutra on the White Lotus of the True Dharma. In Buddhism, Dharma is a word for cosmic law and order understood through the teachings of the Buddha. And in this case, we're talking about Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha who lived in India and founded the Buddhist religion. So Kenji read this new edition of the Lotus Sutra and it changed his life. He quickly converted to the school of Japanese Buddhism most militantly associated with the Lotus Sutra, Nichiren Buddhism. And I mean militant. Kenji joined not just Nichiren Buddhism, but also the ultra-nationalist Kokuchukai, the Pillar of the Nation Society. The Pillar of the Nation Society has a complicated history in the lead-up to the Pacific War. For example, members included Kanji Ishihara, who masterminded the Manchurian Incident in 1931. The Manchurian Incident was a false flag operation that killed more than 340 Chinese people and justified Japan's invasion of Manchuria. Kenji did not know Ishihara. And as you'll hear, he was far too ill in 1931 to have anything to do with the Manchurian incident or any of the Pillar of the Nation Society's political maneuverings in the 1930s. But some people have wondered whether Kenji would have joined in with the machinations of the Pillar of the Nation Society. I guess that's an open question to which there's no way for us to have a real answer. Personally, what I know about Kenji's character makes it difficult to believe. And there's some evidence that Kenji had already become estranged from the group by the end of the 1920s. But anyway, this isn't an episode about Nichiren Buddhism, but there are a few of Nichiren's teachings that are especially relevant to Kenji's life and work. First, as we mentioned, Nichiren teaches that the Lotus Sutra is the greatest Buddhist truth. Second, enlightenment isn't a private, internal thing. It's also a call for action. Buddhists have responsibilities toward the world they live in, particularly to spread Nichiren's teachings, but also in more general terms. You'll see how seriously Kenji took that teaching as we move on. Nichiren Buddhism also teaches that all sentient beings possess their own Buddha nature and that they're capable of attaining Buddhahood in this lifetime. Keep this teaching in mind when you read Kenji. He has a tendency to anthropomorphize anything at all, to treat any animal, vegetable, or mineral as human. Miyazawa also seems to have been a man who could both love the world as it is and see its capacity to be better. And I think that the Nichiren teaching about all beings having a Buddha nature reinforced that capacity. I see it here in the way he talks about himself. He wrote to his friend about his overwhelming anger helping in his father's store. "Anger flares up and my body feels as though it has entered alcohol. Sitting at a desk and remembering someone saying something, I suddenly feel like smashing the desk with my whole body." But he goes on to describe himself, an asura in the world of humans becoming a Buddha. Kenji's edition of the Lotus Sutra defines an asura or an asura, or just shura for short, as an evil deity or spirit fond of fighting and quarrels, who was constantly at war with various heavenly beings. In one Buddhist schema, the asura live in the realm between the realm of beasts and human beings. Kenji suspected that this world, the one we live in, is actually the realm of the asura. I think that comes across in some of Kenji's stranger stories, where the suffering seems totally arbitrary. It would, of course, in a land populated by asura. Kenji even titled his only published volume of poetry, Spring and Asura. The title poem includes the line, "I am asura incarnate." I want to pause here to look at the story, The Bears of Nametoko, as a sort of statement of what a life lived according to Nichiren Buddhist principles might look like when it has to be lived out in the world of asura. According to the Bears of Nametoko, there is a certain mountain, Mount Nametoko, that is famous for its bear's liver. Just to be clear, there isn't a Mount Nametoko in Japan. One Miyazawa fan tracked down a very old reference to a Mount Nametoko towering over Lake Toyosawa in Iwate Prefecture. But anyway, there was once a famous hunter named Kojuro Fuchizawa, who killed the bears for their livers. Nevertheless, most of the bears of Mount Nametoko were fond of Kojuro, as long as he left them alone. And Kojuro didn't particularly like killing the bears either. For one, he thinks he can understand them when they talk to each other. He seems to hold them in a great deal of respect. "Don't think I killed you, bear, because I hated you," he says to any bear he has killed. "I have to make a living just as you have to be shot. I'd like to do different work, work with no sin attached, but I've got no fields, and they say my trees belong to the authorities, and when I go into the village, nobody will have anything to do with me. I'm a hunter because I can't help it. It's fate that made you a bear, and it's fate that makes me do this work. Make sure you're not reborn as a bear next time." So we've got both the bears and Kojiro knowing how they wish life could be, that they could all live in peace, but recognizing the way life is. And Kojiro makes these references to reincarnation and fate. Some things are simply out of our control. Suffering is a fact of human and bear life. Life is different for Kojiro off the mountain. People don't respect him like the bears do, especially not the shopkeeper to whom he sells his bear livers. The shopkeeper always underpays Kojiro, and this is another reflection not just of Miyazawa's concern for the underdog, but also of how much he disliked the way men like his father ran their businesses. Over time, Kojiro grows more and more reluctant to continue his work as a hunter. One bear asks him, "What are you after? Why do you have to shoot me?" And Kojiro replies, "For nothing but your fur and your liver. Not that I'll get much for them when I take them to town. I'm sorry for you, but it just can't be helped. Though when I hear you say that kind of thing, I almost feel I'd rather live on chestnuts and ferns and the like, even if it killed me." One January day, Kojiro tells his 90-year-old mother that, for the first time, he doesn't feel like going hunting. And that's the day a bear finally gets the better of him. Even so, as Kojiro lays dying, he hears a voice crying out, "Ah, Kojiro, I didn't mean to kill you." And Kojiro thinks, "This is death. Forgive me, bears." The story closes 3 days later with the bears, each prostrate in the snow like a Muslim in prayer, gathered around Kojiro's corpse. Kojiro is now at rest in a kneeling position with a chill smile as though he were still alive. To me, it's almost as though the man who has done his best to live well in an unjust world of suffering has become something like a Buddha. Kenji Miyazawa entered the Morioka Higher School for Agriculture and Forestry when he was 19 years old. He was a promising student and earned himself a special position as a research student in geology. His interests were mostly practical, soil science and fertilizer, the kinds of science that would help the downtrodden farmers in his native Iwate. And the theme of Miyazawa's life and stories we're going to examine in this second section of the episode is his desire to fight for the underdog. As you'll see, the underdog takes the form of Iwate farmers, the proletariat, and potential converts to Nichiren Buddhism. By the time Miyazawa had graduated, he had made such a strong impression on his professors that one of them tried to put him on the fast track to an assistant professorship. But shortly after graduation, Miyazawa was diagnosed with pleurisy. Today, pleurisy is a usually harmless inflammation of the membranes around the lungs, at least if it's caught and treated. Harmless, but not painless. I've had pleurisy. It's awful. In Miyazawa's day, the term pleurisy, though, was often used to hide a diagnosis of tuberculosis. Between the disease itself and the knowledge it would never be completely better, Miyazawa realized he couldn't keep up with his research position. He couldn't carry the necessary equipment or the heavy samples he needed to. And his physical weakness was a real blow to a man who hoped to dedicate his life to serving the underdog. He wrote to a friend, "I can't do anything. I plow the land, but I plow 4 square yards, and I rest and rest without interruption. I handle something a little heavy, and I have a spell of cerebral anemia." A few months later, his beloved sister Toshi fell ill while she was studying in Tokyo at Japan Women's University. The immediate cause of her illness was Spanish flu, which was then ravaging the city. But the underlying problem was a bronchial infection that was probably cover for her real diagnosis, also tuberculosis. Miyazawa brought his sister home to Iwate when she had made a partial recovery, and he miserably assisted with the family business. He hated the work so much, he eventually gave up his inheritance in favor of his younger brother. And this was not a common choice among oldest sons in 1920s Japan. The Tokyo Miyazawa visited in the 19-teens was the Tokyo of Taisho Japan. The Taisho era was a period of relative democracy. As always, my history here is a dramatic oversimplification, but the Taisho emperor's bad health weakened the imperial institution. The army's reputation was in shreds after the massive casualties of the Russo-Japanese War, even though the Japanese won that one. The 1910s and 20s saw many, sometimes successful, popular protests. There was a large and reasonably powerful labor movement. In 1925, the government granted universal male suffrage. 1925 was nevertheless not a great year for democracy, as we'll discuss in a few minutes. But although Miyazawa lived in Tokyo for months at a time, he never became a Tokyoite. If you have read anything by an author like Osamu Dazai and compared the setting of, say, No Longer Human to the settings of some of Miyazawa's stories, you'll see that life outside of the center in 1920s and 30s Japan was very different than the settings that Dazai describes in Tokyo. While Miyazawa was living at home in Iwate, he made several unsuccessful attempts to convert his family to Nichiren Buddhism. Let me just note that it's a common misconception outside of Asia that Buddhism isn't evangelical. That might not be the right term, given that evangelical has clearly Christian associations. But there are different Buddhist traditions, some of which look more like what Americans and Europeans think of as religions than others. And some Buddhist traditions, including Nichiren, are very interested in converting other people to their way of practice. In 1921, Miyazawa encountered what he thought of as a miracle. Some Nichiren texts fell off a bookshelf and hit him in the head. He took the event as a divine message that he should become more involved in spreading the good news of Nichiren Buddhism. In less than an hour, he was on the train back to Tokyo with a copy of the Lotus Sutra, an umbrella, and money for travel. When he arrived in Tokyo, he marched to the headquarters of the Pillar of the Nation Society and offered to help them proselytize. They rejected his first offers, but he was persistent. He took up preaching in the street, shouting the Nichiren invocation, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, or Hail the Lotus Sutra of the Wonderful Law. Eventually, the Pillar Society's top aide convinced him that Nichiren believers could best serve their faith by living their faith in the work for which they were best qualified. So Miyazawa became a mimeographer, working a duplicating machine that predates the copier. I'm in my late 30s, but my elementary school still had one mimeograph machine. Many of my listeners probably have never seen anything mimeographed. At night, Miyazawa wrote more than 3,000 pages of children's stories a month. Neither mimeographing nor writing were lucrative gigs. Miyazawa eventually sold one of his children's stories for 5 yen. It was the only money he ever received for his writing during his lifetime. You've probably already gotten the sense that Miyazawa desperately wanted to make a life apart from his father. Totally apart. This return to Tokyo was the only time he ever achieved financial independence. And even this time, he was more or less indigent. Toshi fell ill again after only 7 months, and Miyazawa returned home. At least this time, he didn't have to work for his father. He took a job teaching at the agricultural school in Hanamaki. Miyazawa seems to have loved teaching, and his students seem to have loved him. He dressed casually, he exited the classroom through the window, and he was a genuinely kind adult in their lives. But I should mention here that there's a tendency to make Miyazawa biographies hagiographic, something like the life of a saint. Miyazawa does seem to have been a man doing his utmost to live a good life. As you have seen and will continue to see, he was devoted to making other people's lives materially better. For example, he was known to pay for poorer students' travel expenses, or to treat his entire class to a meal at an expensive restaurant. But many biographies drop facts, like that Miyazawa spent most of his teaching salary on luxuries from Tokyo, though he shared many of his treasures, including albums of Western music. Presumably, he did not share the erotic shunga prints that he bought in Tokyo. He owned about 1,000. Quick disclaimer, you can do an image search for shunga, S-H-U-N-G-A. They are fascinating, but not safe for work. Personally, I find some of the subjects of these prints disconcertingly and unrealistically well endowed, but that's neither here nor there. To whatever extent sexual experience is related to saintliness, one of Miyazawa's closest friends wrote that he died a virgin, and there's no evidence that he was ever in a sexual or romantic relationship. In 1922, Miyazawa began composing the poems that went into the only volume of his poetry published in his lifetime, Haru Toshura, or Spring and Asura, which we mentioned earlier in the episode. His sister Toshi had worked with him when she could, making clean copies of his work. But she died that November. The day his sister died, Miyazawa wrote three gorgeous memorial poems, some of the most beautiful poetry he ever wrote. Miyazawa continued teaching until 1926. It was during these years that he published the poetry collection Spring and Asura and the collection of fairy tales The Restaurant of Many Orders. Both of these were self-published, and both were almost entirely ignored by readers and the literary elite. And as I mentioned, these were the only books of his work published during his lifetime. But Miyazawa thought of teaching as a lukewarm occupation that was going nowhere. So in the spring of 1926, he resigned so he could become a real peasant. As we're discussing in this section of the episode, Miyazawa had always been moved by the plight of the underdog. He couldn't grow up in Iwate Prefecture, in the Tohoku region, without seeing the suffering of hardworking peasants. He knew that some of his students weren't getting enough to eat. He saw the consequences, like a student who passed out during a National Foundation Day ceremony shortly before he resigned. The 1920s were also the age of proletarian literature in Japan. Proletarian literature is literature written about the working class with a specifically Marxist focus. Although Miyazawa is not a proletarian writer, his work often had similar concerns. For Miyazawa, becoming a real peasant meant becoming a farmer. He also shared his academic knowledge about fertilizers and modern farming techniques with his neighbors. He really tried to live in solidarity with the poor farmers who didn't have rich families to fall back on. For example, he ate only vegetables he grew himself, even if they were grown from expensive imported seeds. He was especially fond of tomatoes, which don't naturally grow in Asia or even in Europe. They're a New World food. Of course, as a tuberculosis patient, Miyazawa was hardly cut out for life as a farmer. For example, he tired too easily to keep up with the kind of workload required of a farmer who wanted to support a family. Miyazawa also founded and ran the Rasu Farmers Association. His goal was to establish what he called an agrarian art for busy farmers. The reading list was ambitious. It included authors like Oscar Wilde, Leo Tolstoy, Daniel Defoe, Ralph Waldo Emerson. But the late 1920s weren't a great time for civil society in Japan. In 1925, the Japanese Diet had passed the Peace Preservation Law. The law allowed the special higher police to suppress socialists, communists, and anyone trying to alter the Kokutai of Japan. Kokutai is an extremely fraught word that translates as something as simple as body politic, or something as complicated as Japanese national essence, or basis for the Japanese emperor's sovereignty. Ultimately, more than 70,000 people were arrested under the Peace Preservation Law between 1925 and its abolition by American occupation forces in 1945. Miyazawa continued running the Rasu Farmers Association until 1928. That year, the combination of a bad fever and fear of the secret police ended the group's meetings forever. How did the farmers in Iwate respond to all of this? Their kindest reaction was astonishment. But Miyazawa was often the target of resentment. He didn't have to live this way. Or ridicule. What was this ridiculous rich man even doing? Farmers were angry when Miyazawa's fertilizing proposals didn't perfectly pan out every time he proposed them. The kinds of concerns that motivated Miyazawa to become a real peasant stand out in his story, Ozbel and the Elephant. The story opens with Ozbel, whom Miyazawa presents as a kind of industrial farmer. Ozbel, now there was a fine fellow. He'd installed 6 threshing machines, 6, mind you, and got them going with a steady thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump. I should mention that Miyazawa often uses unfamiliar names for characters and places. Sometimes you'll see names like Ozbel Romanized, translated into English or other European languages, differently in different translations. One day, Ozbel turns around and sees a real white elephant. At first, Ozbel is alarmed, but then he gets an idea. "How would it be if you stayed on?" he asks. "I wouldn't mind at all," says the elephant. And then the narrator nonchalantly tells the reader, "So what do you think?" The white elephant was now Ozbel's property. What will Ozbel do with the elephant? The narrator doesn't know, but he tells us one thing. Ozbel isn't, quote, going to lose any money on it, that's for sure. The narrative voice in Ozbel and the Elephant is probably the most ironic in any Miyazawa story I've read, and it uses the irony to make a pretty damning statement about how capitalists can work and how badly business owners can exploit their labor. Next, Ozbel tricks the elephant with all the trappings of a white-collar job. Surely the elephant needs a watch. The watch just happens to come with a 200-pound chain fastened to the elephant's front legs. And what about shoes? Each shoe comes with an 800-pound buckle. For the next few weeks, the elephant works and works for Ozbel for less and less food. Finally, the nearly starving elephant looks up at the moon and says, "It's goodbye." The moon finally talks some sense into the elephant. "Write a letter to your friends." A helpful boy brings the supplies, and the elephant writes to his friends, "I'm being treated very badly. Please come down from the woods and rescue me." That same helpful boy goes to find the elephants. They're all sitting under a Bodhi tree playing chess. This image invokes a setting, India, where chess was invented, and an image of Buddha, who reached enlightenment while meditating under a Bodhi tree. The elephants read the letter and rushed down to save their friends. They succeeded, but accidentally killed Ozbel in the process. It isn't revenge. The antagonists in Miyazawa's stories are more likely to learn a lesson or get cosmic justice than have the protagonists revenge themselves upon them. Ozbel ultimately gets his comeuppance via karma, and it seems perhaps like a wish that Miyazawa has for the underdogs in his own life as well. The summer of 1928 brought on a drought that promised crop failures all over Iwate. Kenji Miyazawa exhausted himself trying to help his neighbors and eventually developed pneumonia. His family forced him to move home, and he was never able to return to his idiosyncratic life as a real peasant. He never really recovered either, but he did have a brief remission. By 1930, he was able to keep a small garden at his parents' house, and in 1931, he tried to take on work as a consultant for a rock-crushing company. But the work was too much. By September, he was once again sick with pneumonia and more or less bedbound for the next year and a half. By this point, Miyazawa knew he wasn't going to recover and knew he was probably near the end of his life. In September of 1933, Miyazawa felt well enough to watch a fall harvest festival from the doorway of his parents' home. Local farmers were finally convinced that Miyazawa's advice about fertilizer might be worth something. and they didn't realize how ill Miyazawa really was. A group of them came up and spoke to Miyazawa about fertilizer plans for more than an hour, and this conversation proved far too taxing. The next morning, Miyazawa vomited blood. He begged his father to print 1,000 copies of the Japanese translation of the Lotus Sutra, and that was Miyazawa's final wish. He died at about 1:30 in the afternoon on September 21st, 1933. He had just turned 37 years old. In the year or so leading up to his death, Miyazawa spoke to his family and friends about what he wanted to happen to his writing. And he gave a few different answers to different people. He knew his father didn't really appreciate his work. And so he told his father, "Please dispose of these manuscripts as you see fit. They are traces of my misguided thoughts." To a dear friend, he explained his hopes. "In these children's stories, I wrote out the blessed teaching of the Buddhas as best I could. So someday, I'm sure everyone will be delighted to read them." Which, as far as I'm concerned, turned out to be prophetic. It was Miyazawa's younger brother, Seiroku, whom he trusted with his legacy. "I'll give you all my manuscripts. If some publisher comes to you with an offer to publish them, let them. No matter how small the house, if no one comes, don't bother." As I'll discuss in just a moment, a few of Miyazawa's poems were published fairly quickly, and Seiroku was able to protect the rest of the manuscripts during the periods of censorship leading up to the Pacific War, during the American air raids of the 1940s. It's thanks to Seiroku that the bulk of Miyazawa's stories survive. The first real interest in Miyazawa's work began a few months before he died, long after he was healthy enough to do much about it. And that interest was mostly in his poetry. But interest in Miyazawa's life and work began to grow almost immediately after his death. The first international translation of his work appeared as early as 1935, a French translation of one of his short stories. The government of his hometown erected a statue in his honor in 1936. That statue bears an inscription from what has become his best-known poem, written while he was ill in 1931. This is Donald Keene's translation. "Undaunted by the rain, undaunted by the wind, undaunted by the summer heat, with a strong body and no desires, never losing my temper, I will always keep smiling." And the poem continues on from there. Later, a 1957 English-language anthology of Japanese poetry included the first Miyazawa poems to appear in English. When copyright on Miyazawa's works expired in the 1980s, there were a slew of anime adapting his stories. The most famous is probably a 1985 adaptation of what is now Miyazawa's most famous story, Ginga Tetsudo no Yoru. It's a book that has been translated into English several times as Night on the Milky Way Train, Night on the Galactic Railroad, Milky Way Railroad, and Night Train to the Stars. Gisburo Sugii's anime, unlike the story, stars anthropomorphic cats. It was also in the 1980s, following the Japanese Miyazawa boom, that foreign translations of Miyazawa's stories really took off. It's largely thanks to the work of researchers working in and on Japan in the 80s that we English-speaking readers have access to his stories today. I want to end today on one final story because I think it might be an allegory for how Miyazawa thought of himself and his work. John Bester has romanized the title and the title character's name as Gorsh the Cellist. It might also be Gosh the Cellist. Gauche is an English word meaning unsophisticated and socially awkward. Miyazawa knew enough English that I suspect that may have been the word he was going for, so it's the name I'm going to use. Gauche was the man who played the cello at the moving picture theater in town. Movies without sound sometimes had live musicians play a soundtrack. Gauche was just not very good. The orchestra was going to hold a concert, and the conductor kept yelling at Gauche in rehearsal, first for being slow, then for being off pitch, then for having no expression in the way he played. The night after the rehearsal, he sat down to practice, but he was interrupted late into the night by a large tortoiseshell cat. The cat offered to be his audience while he played a piece by Schumann, but instead Ghosh opted for a trick and played Tiger Hunt in India. I guess the cat felt some sympathy for the tiger because the cat was scared out of his wits until Ghosh let him out of the house. The next evening, Ghosh was visited by a cuckoo bird who tried to sing scales with Ghosh. But of course, cuckoo birds don't sing more than a few notes. Ghosh yelled at the bird, who hurt itself trying to escape, before Ghosh broke a window, desperate to let the cuckoo bird out. The next night, Ghosh was visited by a badger cub with a side drum who wanted to learn to play in time with the cello. And then a field mouse and her child visited. Her child was very sick. It turns out that Ghosh's rumbling cello massaged sick animals and made them well again. By this point, Ghosh had developed some sympathy for the animals visiting him. He played for the child, who recovered. Finally, it was time for the concert. The symphony was a huge success, and the audience called for an encore. The only member of the orchestra with a piece prepared for the encore was Ghosh. Ghosh played Tiger Hunt in India, and he played it, quote, with all the energy of an angry elephant, just as he'd done the time the cat had come. And for the first time, the rest of the orchestra realized that Ghosh might not be that bad after all. When Ghosh got home, he had a drink of water, then he opened the window and called out in the direction the cuckoo had gone. You know, cuckoo, I'm sorry about what happened. I shouldn't have gotten angry like that. And this is the way I believe Miyazawa thought about his work. He believed he wasn't all that talented, and that there were things in his character that needed improvement, especially his temper. But when he produced something he was proud of, it was because he learned things from the people and the animals and the living things all around him. So why should we read the stories of Kenji Miyazawa? First of all, because Miyazawa has become one of the most influential children's authors in Japanese history. In our last episode, we talked about how he inspired Hayao Miyazaki, and he has played a role in inspiring countless other children's writers who came after him. Like many of the best children's authors, his stories are deeply meaningful for both children and adults. I hope I've given you enough to look for in his stories that you can buy yourself a copy and find new surprises every time you treat yourself to a fresh reading. And for all its contradictions, Miyazawa's was also a life with a lot to admire. He poured his beliefs into his stories, and I think his beliefs have a lot to offer us in the face of the challenges our society faces today. Don't forget that we haven't even covered Miyazawa's most famous work, Ginga Tetsudo no Yoru. It's definitely worth a read, or two, or three, and a hard think. Today I've been reading from John Bester's collection of Miyazawa's work, Once and Forever, The Tales of Miyazawa Kenji. Bester is both the editor and the translator. Buy your books from our bookshop.org page to support the podcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving a review on your podcast app of choice. The very best way to support Read Japanese Literature is through Patreon for as little as $3 a month. Remember that Patreon supporters get early access and bonus content for every episode, as well as updates on new English language releases of Japanese literature, almost once a week. Thank you so much to all our supporters, and a special thank you to our new supporters, especially Stefan. Find out how you can join us at patreon.com/readjapaneseliterature. We'd love to hear from you about the podcast. There are so many ways to stay in touch. Through the website, bluesky@readjapaneselit.bsky.social, Instagram @readjapaneselit, we're on YouTube/@readjapaneseliterature. Thank you to the Japanese literature groups on Goodreads and Facebook, and to the Japanese literature communities on Blue Sky and Twitter. And thank you, as always, to producer Kaim for today's music, kaimmusic.com.